This is Then and Now. Welcome, everybody. I'm Brad Sham, and we are delighted to be joined by the Cowboys All-Star Center, Travis Frederick, and we're going to give everybody a little peek behind the curtain by way of full disclosure. Travis was kind enough to sit down and have a phenomenal conversation, I thought, which I hope you'll agree when you hear it shortly. We had a great conversation the day before the Cowboys left for training camp. And in the ensuing week and a half, Travis Frederick's life changed a little bit. And so we didn't want to bring that conversation to all of you without updating it. Travis is generous enough to do that. And we also didn't want to try to fool you by pretending that we did it all at the same time. So I'm just telling you now that we're having this conversation several weeks after the rest of the program that you'll hear later. So your patience is probably matched only by your boredom right now at not being able to play. But I do appreciate it very much because you've been generous with your time and very forthcoming with the rest of the world about something that's kind of changed your life a little bit.
Yeah, it definitely is it's very weird is the best way that I can describe it. And it makes the most sense to me to just be forthcoming and be honest with people for the most part and try and get as much information out there as possible, because trying to hide it or trying to describe it in a way that's not true doesn't do service to what it actually is.
Had you heard of Guillain-Barré syndrome when we got on the plane to go to Oxnard?
Absolutely not. I had no idea what that was. You could have said the words to me, and I still would have had no idea what it was.
And the first time you heard it was not the first two or three doctor's appointments, was it?
Correct. I didn't hear it until the doctor's appointment where he told me what he thought it was.
Which was back here after camp.
Correct. He told me what he thought it was, and then the next sentence out of his mouth was, "I think we should go to the hospital." So it was a very quick turn of events after that discovery process occurred.
Okay, so I just want to update people a little bit and then do a very brief kind of background of how you've played with this mentally.
Mm-hmm.
So am I correct in saying that your life is not in danger from this disease? Is that correct?
That is correct, absolutely.
That's good news.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely good news. When I first was diagnosed, there was a question at that point, not necessarily life, but it can take your life. Basically, how it works in a very short thing is that your immune system goes a little bit haywire, and this is caused by a couple of different things. It goes a little bit haywire.
Viral?
Yes. So it can be post-viral. So your body's been fighting off a virus, and it's already in high gear, and something mutates, and it starts attacking. It can also happen after you've received a flu shot. On occasion, that is something which is similar to post-viral. Your body fights off a flu shot. The flu is a virus. It's all the same. And the third case is completely random, and that is where I fall in. So
that's maddening.
Yes, it is. It's also very confusing as we're going through the process trying to figure out what it is and where I got it and all of that. There's not a lot of answers because it is pretty rare and there's not been a lot of research on it. So there's not a lot of answers as to why or if there's a way we could have found it faster or anything like that.
None of which matters now.
Right.
Anyway.
Right.
So they give you the diagnosis, mm-hmm. and your first thoughts are?
My first thoughts are, how is this going to affect my life in the future? While we're going through it, we were trying to figure out what it was. He explained to me what it was, but then said we should go to the hospital. Because in the worst of cases, and as it reaches its peak, it moves very quickly and can paralyze you and also attacks your diaphragm. It paralyzes your diaphragm, which then stops your breathing. So at that point, generally what happens is you get put on a ventilator, and it keeps you there. And then once you convince your immune system to stop attacking your nervous system, and there's a couple of ways of doing that. One is once you hit rock bottom, your body actually just figures it out. And there's two other newer treatments that can occur that essentially cut off that bottom half of the curve and stop the disease from progressing. And so once that occurs, then you stop digressing and you start going into recovery. And recovery is essentially waiting for the nerves to completely heal themselves.
Which they do on their own.
Which they do on their own. And all research that we've been able to come around with and anything that's, journaled or anything like that, there is no way to make that happen any faster. That just occurs on its own. And then after that, it's rehab, it's PT, it's occupational therapy, et cetera, for a normal person. Like I said, I've been really fortunate because we caught it very early. And we got on one of those three things. I got on a treatment that stopped it from progressing. And I was always able to function fairly normally. I've always been able to walk. I was never paralyzed. I never had any issues with the diaphragm or anything like that. But the reason they put you in the hospital, in fact, ICU, is because it moves so quickly that you can go from being standing to not being able to breathe over the course of a day.
Wow. Were you afraid?
I was never afraid. Because of the way that it was all phrased to me, the doctors did a great job of being very forthright with me and sort of took it down a step. I was very fortunate that my doctor is a very bright man, but also very approachable. And he was able to take this sort of quote unquote doctor speak down one level just enough to where I could understand exactly what was going on. So I've been very well informed this entire time. So I think that helped control my emotions and my fears.
How long did it take you to start wondering about playing football again?
It was pretty quick. Obviously, the symptoms were occurring, and I was not able to play football in the shape that I was even before the diagnosis. But after the diagnosis, then it was a week of treatments, effectively.
Which, by the way, let me pardon the interruption, but that's why you thought you had stingers, mm-hmm. and that's why you weren't practicing, because you couldn't function at Travis Frederick level.
Right. Yeah. So it started with the stingers, and that's why I went down to the other doctor, and all of that goes along. So that's what we thought it was, and then once we found it wasn't stingers, we're kind of waiting in there. And while I was out with stingers, I was doing some running, just trying to stay in shape, and things were different there. Things weren't. It just wasn't the same. I was having a hard time with those things.
Like, were you weaker?
Weaker, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so I mean, it's good and bad. People ask me, Travis, do you think that this is better that you found it during football? Do you think that you wouldn't have found it as quickly? And it's hard to say one or the other. I would say probably yes, because the stingers were the first thing that really set it off. But there was also things during training camp that hide that. So I had weakness in my legs that I just attributed to playing football and being in training camp, which is a very normal thing. And then I had weakness in my arms, which I attributed to stingers, which is a very normal thing there. So the weakness sort of went overlooked for a little bit until we had the stinger diagnosis question mark, where we actually started looking a little bit more.
And I'm not even going to ask you when you think you'll be back playing football, because nobody knows. You mm-hmm. don't know. Nobody knows.
That's right.
How, for someone as intelligent as you are, who likes to, you have, as people will hear in as our conversation of July 23rd ensues, you're an engineer. You're that's how your mind works. You look for solutions to problems, mm-hmm. and you find them. And here's a problem without a solution.
Right.
How difficult is it for you to process that and let it happen at its own pace without trying to influence it, which you can't do?
Right. Yeah. I always thought of it as something that I couldn't will myself through. The doctors, like I said, were very forthcoming and told me exactly how it works. And so I said, okay, at this point, we just take it for what it's worth and we keep chugging along. And but it was about a week or two ago when my wife was actually the one that sort of poked me and said, "You're not taking this as it goes. You're pushing too hard." And so at that point, it was the first time that I realized any sort of frustration. And it wasn't with her and it wasn't with the direction we were going. It was just that I should have been progressing faster than I was, and I wasn't. And I just sort of had to take me back
in your mind. It's not that anybody told you. Just
right.
In your mind.
In my mind.
Okay, this is enough. We've done this. I get the joke. Now on with it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so that sort of took me back to that moment of, okay, you can't will yourself through this. This is something that we have to just take our time with.
Are you at peace with the process as it unfolds?
Yes. At this point, I am. And I think that's sort of optimistic. And, you know, I try and take all the information as well as I can. But optimistically, most people get back to 95 or 100% functionality of where they've been, so or more. And so that's where the optimism comes in, saying that that is going to happen for me. And if that's the case, I know it's just a matter of time. So there's nothing I can do to make it go faster, but I have faith that it will get back to that point.
The last thing for right now, before we pick up with the conversation of then and now and give everyone a little closer look at Travis Frederick, has nothing to do with this, but rather is about your foundation and the great work you do trying to feed the hungry. Mm-hmm. And I believe your annual event is...
It's Monday.
Right.
So this will...
So this is going to... you. The first time you folks hear this, the event... to which we make reference later in the conversation, will have happened. And I know it was an enormous success.
I'm sure that it will be. I'm very excited for it.
All right. Thank you for the extra time. We appreciate it. And, you know, everyone's praying for your health and for your human beingness and your family way before the football part.
Thank you.
Maybe everybody is. Most of us are. Yeah.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And it's been an interesting process, but I've felt nothing but support from not only the organization and my teammates and coaches, but people around, the fans and the community. It's been a very stable rock for me to lean on.
So then and now is a little difficult conversation to have with a guy who is as young as Travis is and as early in his career as he is, and therefore, for a little dose of further ago then, we'll kind of take it all the way back to when you were in high school. So Bigfoot High School.
Mm-hmm.
In
Walworth, Wisconsin.
And what was the mascot?
We were the Bigfoot Chiefs.
The Chiefs.
Bigfoot High School was named in honor of one of the Native American chiefs in the area, Chief Bigfoot. So Chief Bigfoot, and then we became the Chiefs.
Do you have any Bigfoot gear left?
I still occasionally wear the Bigfoot gear.
Do you have a Bigfoot, like a cap or a couple of T-shirts
of
that
course.
You wear?
Yeah. I mean, you have to support it. You know, for me, high school was one of those things that's where your pride, and it all really starts at that level. So whenever I get a chance, I try and rep Bigfoot. I get funny looks with Bigfoot, but it's fun.
And then with the beard, which I guess is longer at different times of the year, if you wear a Bigfoot hat or shirt and the beard's particularly bushy, then...
People always ask the question, you know, what makes Bigfoot the Chiefs instead of the Bigfoot Bigfoots, or is Bigfoot actually the name of the school and not the mascot itself? So there's a little conversation there, and I've been asked over the years about the size of my feet on top of that. So
kind of a personal question.
Yeah, it's kind of ambiguous at sometimes, but I think it's really good way to honor Chief Bigfoot and really pay homage to the area and the roots where I come from.
The reason I, and just before we started our conversation, I asked Travis how old he would have been as a freshman at Bigfoot, and the reason that I wanted to start there is that in such a short period of time, I know that Pro Bowl is how we refer to it in the NFL, mm-hmm. but you're all-stars. That's something that it crosses sporting lines. Everyone understands that that means you're one of the very best. And you have been consistently since the second year you were in the league. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder what freshman Bigfoot 14-year-old Travis Frederick thought he would be doing with his life before he was 30, when he was in his late 20s.
I definitely didn't think that I was going to be doing this. It was always a sort of dream of mine, but it goes back even farther than that.
To play professional football.
To play professional football. It goes back even farther than that. I was in fourth or fifth grade. I can't remember now. I had a teacher, a very specific teacher, that we were going around talking about what we wanted to be, what we wanted to do, and sort of our goals for life. And at that point, I told her I wanted to be a professional football player. And she said, Travis, no, you can't do that. It's unrealistic. You need to pick something.
You were how old?
I was probably 11, 12.
Okay.
10, you know, somewhere
so
in there.
So you knew then that that's what you wanted to do, and your teacher said, no, you can't talk about that.
Right. I mean, it's not realistic, which, in all reality, it's a moonshot. There are very, very few people that get to do what we do. And so at that point, she said, you need to do something more realistic. And things sort of shifted over. I enjoyed working with math and science and fell into the sort of STEM careers and went on from there. And so by the time high school came around, I was just interested in taking all the classes, doing science, and I was thinking that I'd probably go into engineering at some point. And my freshman year, I played on the freshman team, and I was clearly bigger than everybody else. It was one of those deals. Bigfoot's a pretty small school. We have enrollment back then was about 550 kids, so I graduated with 120 in my class. And so that puts us in Wisconsin football directly in the middle. There's seven divisions. We played in Division IV. So fairly small school, and I played on the freshman team. So as a freshman, that's just what you did.
Both ways, offensive and defensive line.
Correct. Okay. Yep. And so then my sophomore year, I got a chance to play on varsity, and things started speeding up a little bit, and I said, you know, I think I want to do this still. Like, this is what I want to be. So I go to my head coach. I say, Coach, what do I need to do to get a football scholarship? And so he pointed me sort of in the direction of some guys to look up to.
Now, the coach is not dissuading you.
The coach is not dissuading me at all.
Okay,
no,
good.
The dissuasion came specifically from that teacher. And, you know, I told him I wanted to be a football player, and I wanted to get a scholarship because that was a way that I could pay for school. For me, I wanted to be an engineer. I wanted to go get an engineering degree and not have to pay for it. Was really the end game there. And
you were smart even then.
So my coach points me in the direction of a couple guys, namely Joe Thomas, as number one. And the way that he approached himself in high school and in college was a sort of similar track.
He went to a little bit bigger high school. He must have been a young pro by that point, Joe.
Yeah, because he started in 2006, I believe-ish. Yeah. And I graduated in 2009, so it was really early on in his career. And so I started following him, and my coach gave me drills, and he started putting me on the camp circuit a little bit. I went to Wisconsin's camp a couple of times before, like, the sort of recruiting aspect of it. So that's really where the transition came, that I could potentially be, a college football player. And then things start turning in.
That's from the standpoint, from the point of view of other people. When did the light bulb come on for you that, okay, not only is this something I want to do, I'm good at this?
I think it probably was my junior year.
In high school, when
recruiting started, because coming from a small school, nobody from our school had ever played Division I football. And in my recollection, I'm not sure that anyone ever played Division II football.
Nobody from Bigfoot High School ever played Division I football before you?
Correct.
Okay.
And so it was sort of one of those things that was unish attainable because it had never been done before. And so my junior year when I started to get recruiting letters and I started to kind of feel things out, some of the bigger schools were semi-interested. You know, Wisconsin was playing me far from the vest.
So what were bigger schools that were interested in?
I was getting
a couple other
Big Ten schools like were feeling it out, Minnesota and Iowa namely, but also the academies were a very potential option for me. I would say actually Air Force was probably my number three or number four when it all shook out.
You weren't too big for them physically?
Well, I would have been walking in the biggest person on their team. And they assured me that would be fine.
And now looking back,
they would have definitely slimmed me down, which is exactly opposite of what Wisconsin did, because Wisconsin once, my coach told me he wanted all five guys to play at 350.
350!
And I think that was one of those things you tell people to get there because they'll never actually get there, and they just keep trying.
What did you weigh then?
My biggest that I played at Wisconsin was 348.
But in high school, when you heard that...
Oh, 315.
Really?
Yeah. I graduated high school at 315. I crossed the 300 barrier at my junior year.
And what do you like to play at now?
I play right now about 312, 315.
Okay, yeah. 350. Okay, yeah. So back up. So that's what they said. Okay.
Yeah, and so Wisconsin has this track record of being able to pull recruits out of Wisconsin, especially offensive line recruits, and do it without giving a scholarship. Because when you grow up in Wisconsin, that's what you want to do. But turns out, in my case, I didn't really watch a lot of college football. I wasn't really that interested in Wisconsin as a football school because I was going to get an engineering degree. I was not going to be a football player. And so then you looked at the academies. Aerospace engineering was also one of the areas I was interested in, and Air Force Academy seemed like the no-brain place to go do that. So there was a couple of conversations there. North Dakota State also got in the mix, which is kind of one of those good in-between. They're big, but not quite as big as Wisconsin, Iowa.
Needless to say, at this point, we're not thinking about the national football.
None whatsoever.
We're still thinking about a scholarship to go be an engineer.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so I get an offer from North Dakota State and the academies, and so finally Wisconsin decides, you know, they're going to pull the trigger, and I go up there. This is the first time that I've actually really toured it, because I wasn't dreaming to go there. It wasn't the case, but when I did it, I...
Did that drive them nuts?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think it probably was a different challenge than they were used to having an in-state guy, because they had offered a couple other in-state linemen, and they committed on the spot on junior day, you know, in spring. So it was a little bit different. But when I went up there and I saw the engineering school, and I mean, there's a great engineering program there. And on top of that, I was falling more in love with computers, and the computer science program is really good there as well. So that's sort of where I was like, this is cool. And the football aspect of it became interesting because it was so family oriented, and it was such a group dynamic that I sort of fell in love with. And on top of that, the O-line tradition out of there, if you get to play O-line at Wisconsin, that's one of the best places you can do that.
When was the first time you walked into Camp Randall and said, wow, this is way cool?
I don't know that I went to a game before the recruiting process. So it would have been, you know, maybe my junior year. When I was invited.
And did you think it was cool?
And I thought it was great.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, I'm not sure that there's anybody that walks into Camp Randall, even if you're an Ohio State fan or Michigan fan, that doesn't think that it's an awesome place to play football.
So by the time you're a senior at Bigfoot, you know you're going to be a Badger.
Yes. Yep. I committed in between my junior and senior year and was very excited about that. And then from there, all of a sudden, it switches the process and you start recruiting other people to come to Wisconsin with you. But at that point, I was all Wisconsin.
And at what point at Wisconsin did you, same process, did you realize that you might want to make a living for a while playing football and that you could, that you were good at it?
It wasn't until after my sophomore year that I thought that there was an opportunity to play in the NFL. So I started as a true freshman at Wisconsin, which hadn't really been done before on the offensive line. And it was because of the way that things worked out, just how football is. A couple of guys were injured, unavailable, so they needed an extra body. And I got a chance in there, ended up starting at center the first two games of the season. I had an ankle injury, and then they just kind of kept the hot hand during the season. In the neck, I got hurt at the end of the year, and I ended up playing guard the last two. So I played four games that first year. And then it came to my sophomore year, and like, listen, Travis, we like you. We like the way you play the game, but these other guys are back from injury, and they're good players. So what we can do is we can either redshirt you, and what we'll do is we'll travel you. You're going to be our seventh guy. So two guys go down, we're going to burn your redshirt, and you're going to go in, but we're going to try and keep you out unless it need be.
Or
you can fight and try and get the spot. I can't guarantee you're going to get the spot, and I can't guarantee how much playing time you're going to get. But if you're on the team and you get in, the red shirt is gone. There's sort of no going back from that. So with the help of the coaches, my family, I decided, okay, red shirt is a great idea, you know, because that means these older guys are going to graduate and I'll get extra time. It turns out they did graduate after that year. And that year we had Gabe Karimi get drafted in the first round, John Moff get drafted in the third round, and Bill Nagy get drafted in the seventh round. And Bill was the sixth guy in the line. I mean, he wasn't...
So that all those guys all, that were your redshirt year?
That was my redshirt year.
Okay. And Bill Nagy was drafted
Bill
here.
Bill Nagy was drafted here to Dallas. And 2 years previous to that was Craig Urbick, who I believe just retired, and Andy Kemp, who played a couple of years in the NFL as well. So you saw these guys, and I felt like I fit in very well with John Moffitt and Gabe Karimi, and Bill Nagy as far as on a skill level. So when they got drafted, and namely so high, I was like, well, maybe this is an opportunity. Maybe I have an opportunity to play in the NFL.
Was there at any point in this on this part of the time continuum that that knowledge and maybe even growing into a desire butted heads with the engineer who said inside your head, don't forget why we're doing this to begin with?
I would say the entire time that engineer was really in control, the engineer inside, knowing that the NFL, realistically, when you take a step back and look at it, I mean, I'm living the dream now. And going into my sixth year, it's unbelievable. But in an average NFL career, it was 2 years. That's if you make it. And so I knew that it wasn't necessarily going to be a walk in the park. You know, I wasn't just going to go in because I played at Wisconsin, or I wasn't going to get a chance just because of the guys that had come before me, that I needed to earn a spot through my years in college. And then once you get to the NFL, earn your keep. And that next year, after Moff and Gabe and Bill got drafted, Kevin Zeitler got drafted in the first round, who I thought that I was in comparison with, and Peter Kahns got drafted in the second round. So all of a sudden, everybody that I had played with was playing in the NFL, and at that point I knew, okay, now it's time to excel and work even harder to try, you know, push up a draft stock and be ready to go by the end of it.
From a competitive standpoint, was there something? You're not a big ego guy. Everybody's proud of what they do, and nobody wants to be talked ill of. Was there a little ego pushing up the draft stock kind of thought there? Was it all about maybe a bigger bonus? Or
yeah, I mean, at that point, as bad as it sounds, it really was about pushing up the bonus and being able to make a little bit more money. And
we started off, all you want is a scholarship to be an engineer.
Right.
And nothing wrong with that.
At that point, it still was that. I was going to get to play in the NFL for a couple of years and get a great start to life. I was going to come out without debt, having a scholarship, and then having a little bit of chunk change to find out where I was going. And in the engineering world, you have to spend several years on the bottom of the totem pole before you work yourself up, just like in any life. But because of the experience that you need in your niche, that you have to just spend time working with that product and working with whatever you're specifically doing before you get sort of unveiled.
Does that bother you now?
That I don't get to do engineering?
Yet. You will probably, I'm guessing that you're one of the guys who is smart with his money, and you probably, by most contemporary standards, whenever you're done playing, wouldn't have to work anymore if that was your choice. That you don't seem to me to be the kind of guy who would make that choice. And if, in fact, you still want to be an engineer, you could retire a 10-time Pro Bowler, looking forward to a possible Hall of Fame induction at some point, and say, okay, now I'm ready to be an engineer. And they say, great, there's your cubicle right over there.
You know, things have sort of shifted a little bit as you go in a couple of ways. One, it's like you said, there's that dynamic of being, you know, at part of the top of your game, if not, you know, one of the best at your position in the world at what you do, to going and sitting in a cubicle. That's definitely a challenge and a transition there. But in the engineering world, specifically in computers, the technology that's being used today, that's being engineered today, is light years away from what I was doing 5 years ago at Wisconsin. So for me to even...
So what are you saying? That technology's passed you by?
For me to even touch that area again, I would have to go back and learn everything that's going on.
You and I know that would take you maybe a year, and then you'd be right on top.
But it would be a challenge, because I'm so, even though I try to stay up on it, I'm so disconnected from what the current technologies are, because it's all hidden behind the cloak until they unveil it as a ready product.
And so the things that they're designing and you can't now be, and you can't ahead. Be a top football player without making that a full-time.
Correct. I couldn't be doing that, and I'm not sure you could find a company in the world that would let you part-time into their secret engineering while you're, you know, a national spotlight type of person, which is totally fair. But so, like I said, things have shifted a little bit, where there are different careers that you can fall into in that field that aren't necessarily that cubicle engineer or the guy that's designing technology that's coming out in the future. I mean, at this point, even while I've been playing, I've done a little bit of consulting, software development, and sort of process streamlining is what I call it. Innovation is another thing that you call it. So basically looking at a process, listening to someone tell you about breakdowns in their process and how things are slowing down, or maybe an issue that they're having and solving a problem, maybe writing a computer program to make that better or solve that issue completely.
Are you a football fan?
I am a football fan-ish. Growing up, my family cheered for Chicago. My grandpa's had season tickets there for probably 50 years now. And I went to my first game when I was 8 years old. But if you ask my parents or my grandpa, I didn't really want to watch the game. I wanted to play the game. And it kind of tore me up a little bit when I was young. Our youth program has these age restrictions and weight restrictions. And so I wasn't able to play. And all I wanted to do was play the game. I didn't want to watch the game. I wanted to play the game. And they kept telling me, no, I couldn't do it. I was 9 years old, but I was too big to play on the lightweight team. So I went to play with the middle team, but turns out I was too young to be playing with those kids. So then I had to sit out. And then it was constantly a battle back and forth. I spent a year, my dad was the coach in the middle. I spent a year just practicing. I couldn't play in the games because I was too big or I was too young. And so there was constantly this battle about it. And I'm a fan of the game more than I'm a fan of
watching the game. Now, I know you keep track of the Badgers.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, but on a and now you're a father with small children, mm-hmm. so that will take precedence whenever you have a little bit of time. But, I mean, will you just sit down and watch a college football game on a Saturday or a weeknight when there's one?
It's been way more interesting to me now, having been through it and now in the NFL. Looking back, there's also obviously tremendous pride in the guys from Wisconsin, but also just the beings of college football. For whatever reason, on Saturday night, you know, we're in the hotel, we got nothing to do. Uh-huh. It's football all of a sudden that I'm turning on, whereas previously I may not have done that. Just because, in my opinion, I think college football is exciting. I think it's fresh because of the way that it's always moving forward.
As a fan, you prefer it to the NFL? It's okay to say that.
I think it's just completely different. Right now, I don't want to watch the NFL because the NFL is work.
That's business.
It's business. So when I'm watching a game, I'm not watching the game because it's a good game. I'm watching the game because I want to see the way that they're playing or how we might be able to exploit that.
Yeah. So the kid who only tried to become a college football player to be an engineer and then pushed himself to increase his draft stock so he could get maybe a little more money to help be an engineer, is now smack dab in the middle of one of the greatest traditions in professional sports. And it's hard for me to imagine that there will be a time, given continued good health in the next decade of your life, that you won't be thoroughly enmeshed in one way or another, for better or worse, in the culture of the Dallas Cowboys. How does that strike you? That just seems out of context with all of the rest of your life before you got here.
Yeah, it's definitely a little different. And, you know, like I was saying before, things shift and things change, and you have to sort of roll with the punches, because this life that we live as football players, no matter if anybody, or as professional athletes, I should probably say, as much as anybody tells you, it's not real life. And it's hard to continue to live that real life sort of in the background while you're living this fake on top of the world life. And it's amazing the way that I've learned to deal with it is looking at a guy like Jason Witten, because Jason was the best, is the best, arguably maybe the best of all time. And he still continued to live that life that he had lived before. Football was probably a little bit more.
By live that life, you mean be the same person.
Be the same person and have those underlying life goals and phases of life that were continuing with football. Now, football is very intertwined in that. And a little bit, like I said, a little bit differently than for me, because it wasn't always my goal, my plan to be here. But seeing the way that he was able to be a great father, is able to be a great father, and still be at the top of his game and spend time with a family and do so much for the community, just gives you a path that it can be done on both ends.
So the kid who whose in-state school wasn't falling all over themselves to get him out of Bigfoot, and who was not driven by the like some are the desire to play professional football. Mm-hmm. Was that kid's feelings hurt by all the talk about the reaching? They reached for him when the Cowboys made the trade and right. drafted you 31st. I mean, was that kid's feelings hurt?
The short answer is no, because that wasn't at all what I was going for. Not one bit. You know, I wasn't looking for the approval of people. I wasn't looking to become a famous person. I wasn't looking to become, you know, I wanted to be in the first round instead of the second round because the bonus is better than when it is. Now, on the argumentative side, when you're drafted at the 33rd.
By the way, it's also easier to get a fifth year when you're a first round.
That's correct. The complement to that is when you're the 33rd pick, first pick in the second round, no longer do they have the fifth round option. So technically you hit the free market earlier and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
But for me, being in the first round is better because if you could get the fifth round, let's be honest, I was trying to get a couple of years. I was trying to, you know, get a bigger bonus.
Sure.
And that was it. You know, there was never any look at past that. I didn't know that I could play past that. And now here we are in year six, and it's a dream come true.
Do you were you aware of all that conversation around draft time?
I was aware.
After the draft?
After the draft. I was aware after the draft of that, and it was pretty evident that night how people stood.
Where were you draft night?
I was at home. I knew, so my agent did a great job. Along the process, he shared everything with me, and we had it narrowed down that we were going to fall somewhere between pick 20 and pick 40. Depending on how things happened, that's where it was going to be. It turns out 31 smacked Evan. It was pretty good. He was pretty good,
mm-hmm.
Which isn't always the case. You know, right. They're not able to tell that. But at 18, when the Cowboys traded down, we knew there was a very large chance they were trading down to pick me later in the first round.
And I'm guessing, as a kid, Dallas Cowboys are not on your radar other than just they're a team in the NFL.
At that point, I would have told you that I wanted to play for Chicago or Green Bay.
Sure.
Maybe Detroit. Minnesota, somewhere up there. But after being here, I realized it's the greatest thing that could have happened to me for several reasons. One, because the Dallas Cowboys organization is first class and the fan base is unbelievable. But also because where I live in the state of Wisconsin, it's right on the border of Wisconsin-Illinois. So it's about a 60-40 mix of Chicago and Green Bay fans. And I grew up as a Chicago fan in Wisconsin, so there was always this banter going back and forth. So I decided that if I played in Chicago and played well, all of the Packer fans would have hated me. Or going home would have been an issue. Like I would have had to have that conversation with everyone. And had I played poorly in Chicago, all of the Chicago people would have had that issue. So by removing myself completely from that situation and getting to a team that, you know, sort of is a quote-unquote neutral to that argument, now I find it a little bit easier to go back home and not have those issues.
Full disclosure, I have always had an affinity for offensive linemen. I find them to be, not just because Travis is sitting here, I find them to be, as a rule, as a group, the smartest people on the team, because they have to be, because there's so much to know. Mm. Now I made a bunch of quarterbacks and tight ends mad at me, but who cares? But one of the things over the time I've been doing this that has really struck me is the unusual closeness that has to pervade an offensive line group. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean wide receivers aren't close. They are. Doesn't mean safeties aren't close. They are. There's something different about an offensive line group. The great Hudson Houck, one of the great offensive line coaches in history, who's coached multiple Hall of Famers, once gave me a mushroom keychain, one of the greatest gifts anyone's ever given me, because the deal about the mushroom is it sits in the dark in the corner and grows in manure. Mm-hmm. And that's the joke is, correct me if I'm wrong, that's kind of the life of an offensive lineman.
Absolutely.
Right? What is it about being an offensive lineman that is so unique and bonding?
I think the thing that makes offensive line so unique is the fact that we cannot play for ourselves. Anything that you do that sets you out as a better player than everybody else, in general, is hurting the people around you. Now, there are ways, I play with great players, and you look at the guys across the board. Let's take Zach Martin, for example. Zach is widely known as one of the best at his position, if not the best at his position, because of the way that he plays within our system and the way that he plays the game. He's not out making all-star, awesome big shots on a safety and doing this, but missed his block on the first level. He's doing his job every single time, and people notice that, especially the guys that play with him. And so when you play on the offensive line, you learn that you can't be selfish, and you have to trust the people around you. And that's where the closeness comes from, is that you have to just assume that everybody around you, have to trust that everybody next to you is doing their job so that you can do your job, and ultimately we can sort of hold the skill guys up and allow them to just make their plays and do what they do. And it's the ultimate reward for us when those guys get to the end zone and they turn around and they're excited to celebrate with you, because they know that you helped them get there, and you know that they are the ones that you're sort of riding, and that's why we're going to win the game.
This is your sixth year in the NFL. Mm-hmm. For, I'm going to say, the last four, if not all five, your group has stood out in its unity, the way you walk onto the field for practice together, go out together on Thursday. You're not the only group in the league that does that.
Right.
But it's noticeable, and it's also not an accident.
Right.
How did all that come to pass?
For me, it was my rookie year when I came in, I think, is kind of when things sort of took a jump in that area. From what I had heard guys before, it was a close group, but that wasn't necessarily meaning they were doing everything that we do. We started our Thursday dinners that year.
Your second year.
My first year.
Your first year.
And started doing some of those things. And really, that was Doug Free that started most of that. Doug Free and Mackenzie Bernadeau were the guys that were kind of behind that. They just wanted to bring the group closer together and spend more time with each other, because you'll find, as you know this, but for the people listening that don't, probably 85 to 90% of all offensive linemen are pretty much the same person. You're going to get like a little bit off that are, you know, maybe have played a different position at some point in their career. But for the most part, you can take an offensive lineman from one team and plug him in somewhere else, and the scheme might be a little different, or skill set might be a little different, but his personality will fit into that group. And so you want to be around people that you're like, that are similar to, you have similar thoughts and beliefs to. And so when you naturally have that around you, it just makes it easier and easier to spend time together and do all of those things as one group.
When did you decide? I've teased you from probably your rookie year about your adroitness in answering questions with a smile on your face and at length, and saying absolutely nothing and giving nothing away that you don't want to give away. It's truly an art, and 95% of players don't have it. But there are also a lot of offensive linemen who are cooperative but unwilling to be out in front. You right. clearly made a decision very early mm-hmm. that you would embrace the idea
yes.
of being out in front. How'd that happen?
Well, that was a little bit different than what Doug's vision was.
Doug was not one of those
right.
guys.
Doug as the leader there. Doug fell into that older school yeah. thinking with the guys that when he was a rookie, they told him, you don't talk to the media.
Well, that was Mark Colombo,
yes.
one of your coaches
yes.
now, who used to kangaroo court fine the other offensive linemen who were seen talking to reporters in media time.
Right. And when I came in, I didn't really have a conversation with Doug about it, but I had a plan that I wanted to be able to control my message. So in my mind, when you're not telling people what the message is, they have to either assume it, make it up, or do investigative work to figure out what it is. But either way, it's coming from someone else's mind and not yours. And so as I started to do that a little bit more, I realized that we should be controlling the group message, not just my message. I'm not just telling people that I don't care if you think I was a bust or that I was reached for as a draft pick. Like, that all of a sudden switched over to, we as a group are going to be doing this, and we want to be the best as a group that we possibly can. We're going to be the hardest working group on on our team and sort of lead from that position. And so that's where that sort of sprawled from, that we were going to control our own message and we're going to cooperate and try and help get our thoughts on the table.
Ironically, and you'll correct me if my thinking is wrong, but the fact that you had that attitude and have been as good as you are on the field has opened the door for the Blocking Out Hunger Foundation. Mm-hmm. Seems to me that one of the things you figured out somewhere along the way is I can do something for other people if I have the media willing to listen to my message. Is that too cynical?
No, you're spot on. There's two great things that you can get out of being cooperative with the media. One is you get the benefit of the doubt sometimes. When you're cooperative and you're helpful and you provide answers that are going to help the media do their job, it's their job to get the message from what's in the locker room out. So they're not trying to pin you in a corner or put you in a bad situation. They're just simply trying to relay the thoughts of the team. And so if you're going to help them do that and make their job easier, if something happens or maybe there's something that could be bad, oftentimes the media is going to help you out because you make their life easier, and there's sort of a trade-off there. So that's one of those things. But the other thing is that you also have the media's ear in other things that you're doing, and whether that's endorsements and that sort of it, or it's work in the community and being able to bring together a community. Because like we talked about earlier, the fan base in Dallas is unbelievable. And not only is it unbelievable and passionate, but it's very generous. And I learned that early on in my career as well, how generous the people of this area are and also what need there is. And so that's why the Blocking Out Hunger Foundation spawned, was knowing that there was such a need and such awesome generosity. We just needed to find a vehicle to help move some of that generosity to the need.
And how did that particular one come to you?
For me, I was involved in a company that's based here out of Dallas that works with hunger. And I started doing some of the things with them, going downtown and handing out meals or going and making meals for people that were in need. And that's when I realized that there are so many people that aren't getting the proper nutrition and aren't able to be successful. And when you look specifically at children, they're going to school hungry and can't focus on their schoolwork and can't learn because all they can think about is the food and where their next meal is coming from. And when that happens, all of a sudden we're taking our next generation, the generation that's going to take care of us in the future, and not giving them a chance to reach their potential. So for me, getting kids the proper nutrition so that they can reach their full potential is paramount.
How has, speaking of children, being the father of two very small ones mm-hmm. now changed you? I know how it's made your life different. How has it changed?
Right. Just like getting married and all of a sudden having somebody else that you have to think about in all situations, now you have two little people that you have to not only think about, but really support. And I mean, obviously they can't do anything for themselves. So all of a sudden your life goals are no longer about you or even you and your wife. It's about you and the way that your kids are going to be able to live their life. And working with the Blocking Out Hunger Foundation and children and seeing that and wanting them to be able to reach their potential just raises that level of awareness to me that my kids are going to be in a situation where it's not always going to be perfect, and they're not always going to be around everybody that's perfect and be able to reach their full potential. But you have to do your best to help them have something solid to stand on and teach them the right things so that they can be successful and reach that potential.
I've got just two more short things, but before I get to them, there are going to be people who hear this who are going to come away saying, how can I get involved in helping the Blocking Out Hunger Foundation? Mm-hmm. How do they do that?
Yeah, so our website is travisfrederick.org. And you can go on there. There's information about what we're doing, some of the programs that we put in place, and also our fundraisers. You can also donate through an online link there. The other two things that we have two events that we run through the year. In the fall here, we're going to have what we call Stars and Stakes. And we host a...
You've been doing that 2-3 years?
Yep, this will be our third.
Okay.
Where we host a gala, and you're able to have the Dallas Cowboys players come and wait on you, which is a little unique. That
And your guys all... They're all willing to help you out.
They
right?
are.
Your teammates.
I've been so fortunate. Our guys, it's such a great locker room and such good people. But I've had such a great turnout from my teammates for that. And I think they really enjoy it because you do get to interact with the fans a little bit. But from an aspect of the celebrity waiter, it makes it a little bit easier on them. You're not necessarily talking to one person for 3 hours. You get a chance to talk to 300 people for, you know, 5 minutes or a minute here or there. So it makes it a little bit easier on them. And then so you're going to get to mix and mingle with some of the best on our team at that event, which is really cool. And we raise a ton of money for childhood hunger. And then in the spring, we do something a little bit more casual. We've sort of spun off what your golf outing, your classic golf outing is, and we've moved it to Topgolf, where you simply play a couple of games of Topgolf in a competition format, but for each bay, you get a Cowboys player to come and play with you. So, and again, I get great showing from the guys. They enjoy coming out. There's great food, drinks. There's music going on. There's a little bit of silent auction, a little bit of live auction, but it's really focused on just going out and hanging out and having a good time.
TravisFrederick.org. Okay, if you, these two last things are completely unrelated to each other. If you shaved your beard, mm-hmm. you could walk through any mall in town without being noticed.
I could.
Do you ever want to shave it off, and how did this great growth come to be?
Occasionally I want to shave it off specifically for that reason. But, it's become my brand.
But it has, right?
Yeah, it has. And on the converse side of that, it's become my brand. It's recognizable now, which makes me more valuable, which is, again, sort of on the line of thinking when it's always been. So it's recognizable. But the thing that my wife will tell you is I probably will look 16 years old if I shave my beard off. I have the classic baby face under here. So I've had facial hair since probably my sophomore year in high school, some sort of goatee or a... Fu Manchu, so some sort of facial hair. I didn't really start growing the full beard until college, and it was born of pure laziness. When you're grinding it out in college, you're working out, you're doing football, you know, for however many hours a week that is. But on top of that, engineering, I was up until 3-4 in the morning doing that before going. So I just didn't have time, and I just didn't care enough about it to do anything about it. And so then it started growing and. Just spawn from there.
Last thing, leadership in a group setting comes naturally to some people. Mm-hmm. You strike me as one. Dak Prescott strikes mm-hmm. me as one. In the unique environment of an NFL locker room, when you take someone like a Jason Witten out,
right.
there's a void.
Mm-hmm.
Do you and Zach Martin, Zach got his locker for crying out loud. You know, no pressure.
Yeah, right.
by the way, you were a little peeved that they broke you up.
Yeah, I was. You know, we were doing just fine over there where we were. Tyron was a couple down. We had Jeff Heath and Byron Jones was right there. And just down the way, you know, Dak was over there. I mean, everything was just fine the way it was.
Let's not mess with it.
But they broke us up.
Do you and Zach in particular, and I don't mean to take anything away from Tyron. Tyron's a different personality.
Absolutely.
He says very little. Everyone listens when he says the very little that he says,
That's
but
correct.
He's a different personality. So do you and Zach particularly feel the need in the offensive mm-hmm. room to try to fill some of Jason Witten's leadership void?
I think sort of is the answer to that. It's one of those things that I don't think we have to try to do to make happen. There is a void there, and naturally, the void has to be filled and will naturally be filled. And I think that naturally and organically is the best way to do that. I don't think you can have somebody step up and say, okay, I'm going to be the leader now. I'm the captain now. That's not the case. That naturally happens, and it's because leadership is, like you said, sometimes a natural process. It's who the guys look up to. It's who the guys respect. And that's going to happen naturally, especially with such a great group of guys that we have. Now, you mentioned Dak and Zach, and Dak is one of the most natural leaders that I've ever been around. And on top of that, he has a psychology degree. So he has studied that as well. So not only does he do it organically, but he also has a mission behind what he's doing. But then you just have good people and people that the teammates want to follow. And that void will be filled. And as much as I hate to see Jason go and I hate to see that void be created, it will evenly spread that leadership and that responsibility out over a few other people. And I think that by spreading that out, it takes pressure off of a person and off of the offense in general.
As an offensive line aficionado, may I say, you're fun to watch. Your group is fun to watch work as the perfect example of a team function, win or lose. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome. Thank
great,
you for
very
having
enlightening.
Me.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
That's Travis Frederick. I'm Brad Sham on Then and Now.
Then and Now with Brad Sham is a production of Vocal. For more information and more programming, please visit vocalnow.com. That's VOKALnow.com.